for Jewish Studies here at UCLA. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here today to a conference in honor of the legacy, the thoughts, and the actions of Abraham Joshua Heschel. The conference, Moral Grandeur and Spiritual Audacity, has been in the works for almost 2 years in terms of the idea and the implementation. And I thank my friends and colleagues, particularly Susanna Heschel and Ken Reinhardt, the conference co-organizers, for their wisdom and their persistence in putting together such a wonderful 2 days. Conferences of this nature, the size, the complexity, would not be possible, of course, without many people contributing. We have a number of co-sponsors that I want to acknowledge that made this possible: the Bunch Center for African American Studies and the director Darnell Hunt here at UCLA, UCLA Hillel and its director Chaim Seidler Feller, UCLA History and its chair David Myers, the UCLA Center for the Study of Religion and its director Carol Vacos, the UCLA Department of English and its chair Ali Badad. All were part of making this conference possible. And I do want to acknowledge, and I'll do so again this evening, the indefatigable efforts of the staff at the Center for Jewish Studies, who've been working really tirelessly day and night, as it turns out, over the past few weeks to organize all the logistics for this conference. I will again acknowledge them this evening, but I do want to thank the staff for their tremendous efforts. Today, thank you. We have a number of welcoming remarks, and in the spirit of beginning our conference, I want to welcome to the floor my friend and colleague, the executive director of UCLA Hillel, Chaim Seidler Feller. Thank you.
It wouldn't be an event at Hillel if we didn't have a 3 or 4 introductions to the introduction, but okay. I had some personal remarks that I wanted to make. First, et chata'ai ani mazkir hayom. I reference my sins today, true confession. I went to yeshiva for 7 years, Yeshiva University, where I studied on 185th Street, and I never got on the train to go down 5 stops to get off and visit Heschel. This sort of stayed with me when I realized what I didn't do. I didn't know what I didn't do when I was at yeshiva for most of the time. That was the sort of the tragedy. But I made my connection at some point later on. I would say Heschel became one of my teachers. The Sabbath is the first book that I give to students in my classes. When I taught at UCLA, the basic Jewish studies class, if someone comes to seek to learn about Judaism, it's the first book. When Doreen and I were married, we started our Friday night Shabbat by reading the Sabbath to one another. So it has a very sort of important place in my life. And then I remember that Eternal Light program when Heschel was interviewed by Carl Stern just a couple of months before his death. And Stern turned to him and said, "Dr. Heschel, can you please tell us what Jews think about the next world?" And Heschel turned to him and said, "Mr. Stern, I have to disappoint you, but no one's ever come back for the next world to tell me anything about it." And the issue is what we do today and tomorrow, right here. So one understands why he was our teacher. What I'd like to do for 2 minutes is to remind you all who Abraham Joshua Heschel was. Because I think many of us remember him as the rabbi who marched with King, as the spiritual voice that opposed the war in Vietnam. I see some gray hairs here. And as the theologian who confronted and transformed Vatican doctrine. Indeed, he was a prophetic leader and activist who spoke truth to power. But who was he really? What was his essential makeup? Abraham Joshua Heschel was a chassid all his life. Don't forget that. He was the descendant of the Ohev Yisrael. Right? I brought you a copy. This is the Ohev Yisrael, Avraham Yoshua Heschel of Op, the lover of Israel. Right? So this was the legacy that he carried with him. That was his identity. He was the embodiment of the Ohev Yisrael, the lover of Israel, whose love radiated outward to humanity. And he bequeathed to us a spiritual vocabulary that unlocked our souls and framed our religious experience. It was a language of poetic antinomy, ecstasy and despair, law and love, keva and kavana, discipline and spontaneity, halakha and agada, philosophy and kabbalah, reason and emotion. He gave meaning and purpose to our contradictory inclinations that so naturally coexisted within him. And in so doing, he set us on a path to unity and to wholeness. We're here today to remember Heschel and also to seek inspiration from his teachings. It's my honor to welcome you to 2 days of learning and reflection devoted to the teachings of Avraham Joshua Heschel. Thank you.
Thank you, Chaim. I'm Ken Reinhard, and I'm delighted to be here, and thank you all for being here. I first read the work of Avraham Joshua Heschel about 23 years ago when my rabbi, Eli Spitz, who I'm not sure if he's here yet, but he will be, when he told me about Heschel's concept of the architecture of time. Talking to the mic, okay. Of course, from the Sabbath, which Chaim just mentioned, and I'm sure many other people will mention today. I was profoundly moved by Heschel's idea that time is ours to design, build, and inhabit, just as much as space is, that it can be sanctified and elevated beyond the great vacuous trickle of vanishing present moments and the soul-numbing limits imposed by the daily clock. Heschel's ideas were based on the biblical concept of Shabbat as the active crafting of rest, as a positivity, rather than just the absence of work, in imitation of God's rest from the work of creation. We recall that the Torah doesn't say that God stopped working after 6 days, but that he finished his work on the seventh day. The rabbis clarify that it was rest itself that God made on the Sabbath. For Heschel, this meant that Sabbath is not just a time for the body to recover from work, but a new experience of time itself, a taste of eternity in the present. His idea that time can and must be made holy, struck me as a profound insight, one with political implications as much as theological ones. We know all too well the terrible cost incurred by the sanctification of space and the idolatry of land throughout human history. In the alternative private prayer following the silent Amidah in the Sim Shalom Siddur, we ask God to help us extend the liberating joy of Shabbat to the other days of the week. It's not only the day of rest that we are told to keep holy, and which we accept gratefully as a relief from work. We are enjoined to sanctify all the days of the week, and work itself, to grant it the dignity of divine labor. As I read more of Heschel's work over the years and learned about his extraordinary life, I realized that his insistent call for social and political justice in many ways sprang from these theological insights. How can we experience divine time if it is confined to only one day of the week? How can we rest while others must labor? How can we enjoy freedom when others are enslaved? Heschel's ideas transformed my experience of Judaism, both intellectually and personally, and I strove to extend the liberating joy of his ideas to all my thinking and teaching. When I first met Susanna Heschel 7 years ago, I told her that her father was my hero and that I wanted to have a conference on his life and work at UCLA. It's taken a while, but the day has finally arrived, and I'm thrilled, and I know Susanna is too. Thank you, Susanna, for supporting this and for everything you've done for me. And thank you all for being here. And I want to thank in particular Chaim Seidler-Feller, not only for his support of our conference today, but for everything he's done for UCLA and for me personally over many years. My 26 years at UCLA have been immeasurably enriched by his work and teaching. I'm grateful in more ways than I can express to him and to Susanna for her friendship, her courage, her honesty, and her intellectual and moral passion. I would like to dedicate this conference to both of our fathers, whose memories are indeed a blessing. Thank you. And I'm pleased to introduce Susanna Heschel.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy about this day, that this day has arrived. And I want to thank everyone who's helped make it possible. I thank you, Todd Pressner, the director of this wonderful Jewish Studies program here at UCLA. Thank you for all that you've done. I thank Rabbi Chaim Seidler-Feller, who for many years has led the best, the most exciting, the most stimulating Hillel on any campus, anywhere in the U.S. and abroad. You know, you have a really great intellectual leader in Rabbi Seidler-Feller. You know that, don't you? You know that at UCLA. I thank you so much also to Chelsea, to Vivian, and to Raina for all that you've done to organize, and Ken Reinhardt. I thank you so much. When Kenneth Reinhardt first suggested to me making a conference at UCLA, I was thrilled. I was thrilled, first of all, because of the opportunity to work with Ken Reinhardt, who is somebody whom I admire enormously for years. He is a great scholar and a forward-thinking person. When I read his work, I think, my goodness, I've just jumped 10 years into the future because he is so stimulating. And I thank you so much for your idea for this and for making it possible and for honoring my father in this way. And I also, as I told you, I'm so thrilled that this is at UCLA because when I was growing up, my parents used to often come to spend the summer here at LA, and I always feel that I half grew up in Los Angeles. We were in New York City, and we would come to LA, and it was a different world, as you know, LA, the sun, the flowers. And in those days, by the way, the weather was always 70 degrees. It was gorgeous. We would rent a house somewhere nearby in Westwood with a piano for my mother, who was a pianist, and my father couldn't drive a car. My mother was terrified to drive, but she would drive sort of 10 miles an hour to drop my father off at the library at UCLA, and you knew it was summer because my father always wore a suit. It was either blue or gray, but he didn't wear a tie in the summer, so then you knew the summer. And he loved being in the library at UCLA because UCLA, you have a fantastic collection of Hebrew books that had been accumulated after the war by a wonderful bibliographer. I forgot his name.
Shimon Brisman,
thank you. But you know what my father said? He loved the library because the books were always on the shelf. Those were the days before you developed the great Jewish Studies program that you have today. There were still a few wonderful people here, and my parents had some great friends. I see you have a David Dortort art gallery, and my parents were friendly with David Dortort. Also, he produced Bonanza. My father never saw it, but he liked David Dortort. And but there were so many other friends besides. So those were wonderful days. My mother's family lived in Los Angeles, which is why we came. And I especially have to remember the Sundays when we would go to my uncle's home. My uncle played the violin. He was a physician. He played the violin and had two pianos in his music room. And there was chamber music all day Sunday. And then in the evening, we would go for dinner to Hartman's. Do you remember that? That was the only kosher restaurant in Los Angeles in those days. So it was a wonderful, it's a wonderful memory, those summers in Los Angeles, and I thank you for this. I think that the best way to open this conference and listen to the wonderful lectures that are about to come, and I want to thank all of those who have prepared what are really excellent papers and all of those who are coming to comment on the papers and to lead the breakout sessions. But I think the best way to open this conference is to hear my father's voice. And I say, especially given the first two papers we're going to hear today from R.E. Cohn and from Donald Pease, I've chosen just 3 minutes to hear my father, 3 minutes of a lecture that he gave. I'll just tell you that this is a lecture from 1963. It was a few months after my father met Dr. King in Chicago. He invited Dr. King to come with him to a gathering of leaders of the United Synagogue Movement of Conservative Judaism who were gathering at the Concord Hotel in the Catskills. There, Dr. King spoke, my father spoke. They spoke about issues of race. And I have to say how grateful I am that today, this time in the United States, with all that's happening, that we are so honored to have Dr. Cornel West to help us right now in this state of emergency, in this moment, as well as Dr. Pease and Dr. Cohen. My father spoke about race. He spoke about Soviet Jews who weren't allowed to practice their Judaism. And he ended that speech with 3 minutes that I'm going to play for you, in which he spoke in Yiddish. And I have an English translation that I'll put in the PowerPoint. I want you will understand some of the Yiddish, even if you don't know Yiddish. And you'll hear his voice. Yiddish was my father's first language. He rarely had an opportunity to speak in Yiddish, except when he went to Winnipeg, which was a great city. People knew Yiddish, and he could give a lecture in Yiddish. But he was able to speak from his heart, and you'll see something also in his voice, and I think also in the language that he uses. He's speaking about a Jewish issue, but he's speaking about we human beings, all of us. So let me open this conference today with some words from my father.
Für uns, weil wir haben eben schon verloren, bin ich schon. würde nicht an meinem Treffen Angst. Mit zügen Kind ist, wenn er mir nicht schuld zu sein. Und so ich glaube nicht, dass die Stunden kommen waren. Und so ich glaube, dass ich bin in einem Impfer. Ein Impfer auf eine gewöhnliche Frage. Was ist der Heu für den gestrigen Tod? What is the past? Not to forget. Never to be indifferent to other people's suffering. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is David Myers from the History Department here at UCLA. I'm really delighted to be part of this conference, which has begun in such extraordinary fashion. And thank you so much, Susanna, for sharing that extraordinarily powerful piece of your father's teaching with us. We're here to reflect on the legacy of Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great theologian, scholar, and activist. And it is especially fitting, I think, and I should add pleasing, as Susanna mentioned, to have this conference here in Los Angeles and at UCLA, where, if I'm not mistaken, were your parents married in Los Angeles?
Yes, they
were married in 1946. In addition to the time spent in the library, this is also a very significant venue for the Heschel family for other reasons. It's also, I think, fitting to start with Professor Aryeh Cohn of the American Jewish University, who shares a key quality with Abraham Joshua Heschel. That is, Aryeh has the mind of a rabbi and the soul of a prophet. As I think we'll hear in the course of his paper, Aryeh, moreover, has distinguished himself both as a scholar and an activist in ways that recall Heschel's bold legacy. Aryeh is the author of two books that reflect these two facets. He revealed the richness, the daring, and the originality of his Talmudic cast of mind, his Gemara Kopf, in his first book from 1998, entitled Rereading Talmud, Gender, Law, and the Poetics of Sugiyot. And he revealed the ethos to which Heschel gave such memorable expression in Selma, namely the ethos of praying with one's feet, in his 2012 book, Justice in the City, an argument from the sources of Rabbinic Judaism. Both of these books reflect Aryeh's ability to parse and illumine the dense and complex world of rabbinic discourse, but also make evident his impulse to see the hermeneutical practices and ethical norms of the rabbis as the source of our moral imperative to act justly in the world. And so with that, it is a delight to welcome my friend, my colleague, teacher, occasional chavruta, and inspiration, Aryeh Cohn, to open our discussion this afternoon. Aryeh.
Thank you so much. It's a real honor to be here to open this conference. Thank you to Susanna, who moved someplace else. There she is. Susanna, and to Ken for inviting me, and for everybody who's been organizing. And it's a pleasure to be introduced by David Myers, who is a longstanding friend and colleague and compadre. Can you hear me? Okay. Is there any way to make this thing a little bit higher? Okay. Okay, I'll try to do this. I'm reading off the... Okay, here we go. Is that good? Okay. The question that I engage in this lecture is the following. What brought Abraham Joshua Heschel from his study at the Jewish Theological Seminary along the long and winding path which ended at Riverside Church? In other words, what was it that pulled Heschel to leave his study and take to the streets, both literally and figuratively? I'm not, of course, the first person who has asked this question, nor the first who offered an answer. Heschel himself offered the following answer, and I quote, "Early in my life, my great love was for learning, studying, and the place I preferred to live was my study and books and writing and thinking. I've learned from the prophets that I have to be involved in the affairs of man, in the affairs of suffering man. According to Heschel, it was the translation of his dissertation and the publication of it as The Prophets which called him out of his office. Daniel Breslauer phrases the challenge slightly differently. Heschel never spells out, and this is a quote from Breslauer, Heschel never spells out the justification for his social involvement. As a Jew, his ethical commitment presumably should arise from halakha, from Jewish law. As a member of a democratic society, presumably it should arise from the social contract to which he has subscribed. Heschel, however, develops neither of these premises, end quote. Breslauer raises an additional challenge. Why does Heschel not spell out the Jewish commitments of his ethical actions? Why does he not spell out their basis in Jewish law? As an aside, I would suggest that there is no reason to think that Heschel's ethical commitments should arise from halakha. Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook's ethical commitments, for example, to the land of Israel, for and against war, to moral actions, are almost never framed in halachic terms. Rabbi Aaron Shmuel Tamaris's commitment to nonviolence is never framed as a halachic obligation in classic terms. The idea that halacha is the only source of ethical commitment is exactly what Heschel, and before him Bialik, objects to. David Novak points towards something important but never quite gets there. Quote, to paraphrase a famous rabbinic text, only moral action grounded in theological learning and reflection can rise above mere political activism. Abraham Joshua Heschel was first and foremost a Jewish theologian who, when the hour was right, allowed his great theological learning and reflection to bring himself and others with him to authentic, Jewishly informed political praxis. End quote. Novak puts his finger on something here, but does not explain what that something is. The connection between Heschel's theological learning and reflection and the, quote, authentic, Jewishly informed political practice is left to the serendipity of the right hour. Novak gets us no closer to explaining what, if anything, make Heschel's political actions Jewish, or necessary because of his theological reflection. Novak, unfortunately, is too invested in pointing out that liberals don't know anything to notice that he really hasn't said anything. I want to suggest, contra Heschel himself, that the impetus for Heschel's activism is found not in the prophets, but rather in what might be considered as the first part of his magnum opus, Teramina Shemayim Bas Paklaria Shel Adorot, translated by Heschel as a theology of ancient Judaism, but more felicitously by Gordon Tucker as Heavenly Torah. And I'll refer to the book as Heavenly Torah throughout this essay, whether I am quoting Heschel's Tucker's translation or translating from the original. I will suggest that Heschel's activism is a religious solution to a theological problem, a problem which is spelled out in Heavenly Torah as the tension between Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva. Whereas in the prophets, Heschel describes God as suffering on account of Israel, in Heavenly Torah, Heschel describes God as suffering with Israel. Moreover, this suffering, according to Rabbi Akiva, is an instance of the partnership between God and Israel. This partnership is worked out and presented as a problem in Heavenly Torah. But most importantly, it is presented as an ongoing problem in history and played out by real people in history. That is, the vulnerability of God and the role of actual people in history giving strength to God is theorized and debated in Heavenly Torah. I will further suggest that this is a uniquely Heschelian model of what Oscar Romero, the martyred bishop of El Salvador, referred to decades later as the Transfiguration. So, to sum up the problems with this presentation, I'm going to make an argument about Heschel's philosophy based only on one of his many books, though in my defense, many scholars of Heschel make their arguments while ignoring this book. Then I will defend that argument based on a Christian liberation theologian whom Heschel did not know and who wrote a decade after Heschel died. As a point of departure, it is interesting to compare Heschel's dedication of Heavenly Torah with Immanuel Levinas' dedication to Otherwise Than Being. Both originally Eastern European Jewish philosophers dedicate their books to family members and others who died in the Holocaust and the Shoah. Both accompany their dedications with rabbinic citations. Their citations, however, are very different. Levinas cites Ezekiel 9:4-6, and then refers to the commentary of Rashi. And this is his quote. The sages have said, do not read, begin at my sanctuary. but begin with those who sanctify me, as teaches the Talmudic treatise, Sabbath 55a. The ellipsis, which I so elegantly voiced as in Rashi's comment, was placed there by Levinas. It elides the following, quote, those who are sanctified to me, that is, those who have the sign inscribed upon them, those who are not to be harmed, God recanted and commanded that they be killed, since the aspect of judgment said before God, why are these different from those? Behold, they did not protest against them. Rashi's comment is a reference to a long discussion in Tractate Shabbat of the Babylonian Talmud. The citation is to a very radical midrashic reading of Ezekiel 9 in order to especially condemn the righteous who stand by while evil is being done. In Ezekiel 9:4, the righteous who are marked are to be saved. Quote, kill off graybeard, youth and maiden, women and children, but do not touch any person who bears the mark. In the midrashic reading, it is those righteous of Jerusalem who are initially struck because they did not protest against the wicked. These righteous are those who kept the Torah, as the Talmud says, from Aleph to Tav, from beginning to end. As Catherine Chellier writes, this epigraph is significant. It is linked to Levinas' main idea of election as an infinite responsibility. The calling is indeed a calling to responsibility for the other, without explanation and without justification. Levinas' dedication frames his reaction to the Shoah in terms of the responsibility of those who stood by. The calling to a responsibility for the other, which is not a bad interpretation of the discussion in Tractate Shabbat, would seem at first glance to be a text that would resonate for Heschel. Surprisingly, this is a passage that, as far as I can find, does not appear in Heschel's work at all. It is definitely not a central focus in Heavenly Torah. That Heschel did not just forget about this text is made obvious by the fact that he cites the very next discussion, which is about suffering, in a number of places, and it is a central focus of Heavenly Torah. However, Heschel's leaving this text out of his discussion in Heavenly Torah is surprising only if one misunderstands Heschel's activism. That is, this text is a perfect proof text for demanding that one protest against evil. In fact, the beginning of this discussion in Bavli Shabbat is the statement that if one sees an injustice being done anywhere in the world and does not protest, then one is punished along with the wrongdoers. Heschel's activism is not defined by these parameters. Heschel sees his political activity as an embodying in the world of the partnership between God and people, embodying God's share of Israel's suffering, and more importantly, Israel's sharing in God's suffering. Heschel, on the other hand, cites the following midrash as his epigraph. Quote, the rock, his deeds are perfect, yea, all his ways are just, from Deuteronomy 32. If another person had said it, they would have derided him, saying, how does this one know the ways of the Holy One, blessed be he? However, Moses, a rabbi, of whom it is said, quote, he made his ways known to Moses, his deeds to the children of Israel, from Psalms 103, he is fit to proclaim, the rock, his deeds are perfect, yea, all his ways are just. As Robert Eisen has argued, this midrash is an Akivan midrash of theodicy. Heschel's explicit discussion of this midrash later in the book, and his allusion to it, all point to the Akivan theology that one cannot presume to understand God's ways in the world. Heschel, then, opens his book with a statement to the effect that the Shoah is not the object of our discussion because it is beyond our ken. For our purposes, the interesting point is that the book does not start out with a demand for justice, an articulation of righteous rage, or even a demand for responsibility toward the other, a la Levinas. The book starts with a declaration that one cannot understand the divine accounting. Heschel's project in Heavenly Torah is to limb rabbinic Judaism as being articulated by two different schools. These two schools are not confined to late antiquity, to the land of Israel and Babylonia. These two schools of thought generate the lines of thinking which divide rabbinic thought throughout the generations. It is not surprising that in the second part of Heschel's magnum opus, the focus is on two Hasidic thinkers rather than two figures central to the Mishnah and the Judaism of the second century CE. The two schools of thought are attached to two personalities, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael. It is highly significant for Heschel that the two schools of thought are attached to two actual people. Quote, the fact that at a crossroads in history, two fathers of the world met, men who were to become trailblazers in religious philosophy, is of major importance. The meeting of intellectual giants of opposing aspirations who debated on issues of ultimate significance inevitably laid bare problems in religious faith that the sages tended to conceal, end quote. One of Heschel's goals in the introduction to Heavenly Torah is to resurrect Rabbi Ishmael as a historical figure. Again, quoting Heschel, the life of Rabbi Akiva and his profile became the subjects of many books and articles. But about the life of Rabbi Ishmael, our knowledge is scant. Scholars have barely treated it, and for this reason, we shall here point out a few details concerning his life. End quote. The lives of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael are not then insignificant for understanding their thought, according to Heschel. In fact, several times Heschel writes in the historical mode. For example, quote, in the generation of Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva, there were many cruel and tragic acts. Or, quote, Rabbi Akiva amazed the people of his generation with acts of courage. He was not afraid to bring upon himself the wrath of the haters of Israel. One question that I will attempt to answer is why, if the schools of Akiva and Ishmael represent opposing positions which exist in every generation, is it important that these positions be embodied in specific individuals? Back to the outlines of Heavenly Torah. Heschel argues that Akiva's theology has an immanent God, a demand for a personalistic love of God. That is, the command to love God is understood as just that, loving God, a command to evoke an overwhelming, perhaps ecstatic emotion of love toward God, and an expansive understanding of the obligation to die for the sake of God. Theodicy, or the understanding of human suffering, is beyond human understanding. Some human suffering is brought about by God out of love for God's righteous people. This is called Yisurin Shel Ahava, or sufferings of love. Some suffering is brought upon people in this world, so they will be rewarded in the world to come. Then, the understanding that every single word of the Torah was given to Moses at Sinai, and therefore, that the language of Torah is a divine language, which is never truly accessible to humans, and therefore also endlessly interpretable beyond the rules which one would use to interpret a text whose author was flesh and blood. Rabbi Ishmael, on the other hand, believed in a transcendent God, citing Rabbi Yossi's statement in the Midrashic collection, Mechilta de Rabbi Ishmael, that Moses did not go up to heaven, nor did God come down upon Mount Sinai, believed that one loves God through fulfilling mitzvot, commanded actions, as it is impossible for a person to love God. And he, that is Rabbi Ishmael, has a narrow understanding of the obligation to die for the sake of God. Human suffering, moreover, is always a result of sin. The Torah was not dictated word for word by God to Moses, according to Rabbi Ishmael, and the language of Torah, being a language, is given to interpretation just like any other language. In a paradigmatic exchange, Rabbi Akiva reads the phrase, quote, and the frogs emerged and covered the land of Egypt from Exodus 8:2, concentrating on the anomaly that actually the Hebrew word for frogs is written in the singular, sfardea. Akiva then interprets that one giant frog came and sat on Egypt. Rabbi Ishmael castigates him and sends him off to study purity law. Rabbi Ishmael's hermeneutic principle is the Torah speaks in the language of man. That is, one can apply all the available tools to understand Torah, but the Torah is not to be understood fantastically. In a word, one might characterize Akiva as a mystic and Ishmael as a rationalist. And I look out and I see Elliot Wolfson, and so I use that word in kind of a generic lay person's term. I want to focus on one of the areas of disagreement between the two schools, the love of God and cleaving to God, Dvekut. The issue is framed as centering on the manner in which to understand three central biblical verses. Deuteronomy 4:4, while you who held fast to the Lord your God are all alive today, Dvekim. Deuteronomy 11:22, if then you faithfully keep all this instruction and I command you, loving the Lord your God, walking in all his ways and holding fast to him. And Deuteronomy 6:5, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. The theological question is, can one actually cleave to God? Or as a midrash that Heschel ascribes to the school of Rabbi Ishmael puts it, quote, is it possible for a person to go up to the heavens and cleave to the fire? Rabbi Ishmael's answer is no. His school supplies a number of alternatives for what might be implied by the command to cleave to God. One is commanded to cleave to scholars and their students. one must follow in the ways of love and truth, as these are God's ways. Or again, just as God clothed the naked, so you must clothe the naked. Just as God visited the sick, so you too must visit the sick. On the other hand, Rabbi Akiva answers emphatically that a person must actually cleave to God. The proof text is the following. Quote, just as one who cleaves to impurity, the spirit of impurity rests upon him. One who cleaves to the Shekhinah, is it not just that the Holy Spirit should rest upon him? End quote. There is also this emphatic statement in the Tractate Sanhedrin, distinguishing idolaters from those who worship God, claiming that, quote, you who held fast to the Lord your God, like two figs stuck to each other. Finally, Heschel cites a midrash which compares the love of God to Israel with the love of Shechem to Dinah, based on the use of the verb chashak, lust or love, in Genesis 34:8 and Deuteronomy 7:7. In this Akivan statement, the love of God for Israel is the same sensual erotic lust that Shechem had for Dinah. The Akivan theology is an unembarrassedly embodied understanding of God in which there is an actual physical likeness between God and people. Akiva claims that since people were created in the image of God, therefore, one who spills another's blood, it is as if they diminished the image of God. The split over love of God is somewhat similar to this. Rabbi Ishmael's starting point is that it is impossible to love God. How then might one fulfill the command to love God cited above in Deuteronomy 6:5? Love for Rabbi Ishmael describes the attitude of the one who performs a commandment. Love is an adverb. Alternatively, in a statement attributed to Rabbi Judah the Prince, if you keep the commandments in your mind, you will come to recognize the one who spoke and the world became, and you will cleave to his ways. Or again, that you should act in such a way that other people will come to love God as a result of your good behavior. Akiva, on the other hand, understands the love of God as an ecstatic love even unto death. Akiva's midrash in Deuteronomy 6:5, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might, is located by the Babylonian Talmud at the moment of his martyrdom. Quote, when Rabbi Akiva was taken out for execution, it was the hour for the recital of the Shema, and while they combed his flesh with iron combs, he was accepting upon himself the kingship of heaven with love. His disciples said to him, our teacher, even to this point, he said to them, all my days I have been troubled by this verse, with all your soul, which I interpret even if God takes your soul. I thought, when shall I have the opportunity of fulfilling this? Now that I have the opportunity, shall I not fulfill it? He prolonged the word echad, one, until he expired while saying it. For Heschel's Akiva, the love of God was a demand for an ecstatic love which superseded all other demands, even life. A midrash attributed to Rabbi Akiva's student, Rabbi Meir, derives the model of with all your soul from Isaac, who was bound on the altar. Akiva's religious temperament was wildly romantic, constantly desirous of God and the closeness to God. On the other hand, Rabbi Ishmael did not desire closeness to God. Rather, for Ishmael, God was transcendent and unreachable. The connection with God was through the actions of performing the commandments. In the structure of this section, the citation of Akiva's martyrdom story is a key moment. He finishes and ends this chapter recounting this tale. Heschel will also end this section with the beginning of the story of Akiva's martyrdom, without their mentioning the martyrdom. It will be understood. This story and midrash are Akiva's crest. The split between loving or holding fast to God and accomplishing that only through performing the commandments is thematized later in this section, with a discussion of kavanah or intent in a short chapter with that title. The dispute there is whether the intent that is necessary when performing a commandment is an intention to fulfill the commandment or to the substance of the prayer, or whether the intent must be toward God. Heschel aligns Rabbi Ishmael with the former opinion, using as one proof text an anonymous statement in Tosefta Brachot. One who prays must orient, yechaven, his heart. Heschel juxtaposes this statement with the Mishnaic statement, one who is reading the Torah and the time to read the Shema arrived, if he orients, kivein, his heart to fulfill with his reading of Torah the obligation of reading the Shema, he has fulfilled his obligation. The kavanah, or intent, or orientation, is here to the fulfillment of the obligation. Rabbi Akiva is assigned the latter opinion, for it, quote, for in his thoughts and his actions, he was drawn to the path of the righteous, according to Heschel. Heschel contrasts the Tosefta's version of the statement about intention of the heart with the version in the Babylonian Talmud. One who prays must orient his heart toward heaven. This coincides with the Mishnah upon which the Talmudic discussion is commenting. Quote, the early righteous ones would tarry for an hour and then pray in order that they may orient their hearts to the place. It's capital P place. Akiva then demands that a person performing a ritual not be thinking about how to perform the ritual, nor about fulfilling the obligation, but rather the person must be oriented toward God. This accords with his demand that cleaving to God and loving God must be understood literally. Rabbi Ishmael, on the other hand, demands that the ritualist's intent be to fulfill the commandment. When one prays, one should be concentrating on the words of prayer, and so on. Heschel's analysis here is not cut and dried by any measure. He is working hard to align these two on this issue. This chapter on Kavanah, orientation, is important. Though, is important as it sets up the focus of the next chapter. The next chapter, the last in this section, does a lot of work for Heschel and for the book Heavenly Torah. Heschel begins by citing the famous debate about whether study of Torah or the action of performing the commandments is greater. Rabbi Akiva is cited as saying that study is greater. Others say that action is greater. The majority opinion is that study is great because it leads to action. This then is the first dispute. Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion that study for its own sake is the greatest activity. Others, and by implication, this means the school of Rabbi Ishmael, hold that performance of the commandments is greater. Following on this distinction, Heschel draws another, the distinction between the study of Torah for its own sake, or perhaps for the sake of heaven, as opposed to the study of Torah as fulfilling a commandment amongst other commandments. Heschel draws this distinction with the help of a dispute about the interrogation of a person upon death in the heavenly court. Rava claims that the interrogation begins with the questions, have you dealt in business faithfully? Have you established time to study Torah? Rav Hamnuna, on the other hand, states, the beginning of a person's judgment after death is only about matters of Torah, divrei Torah. While Ishmael is identified with the former opinion by way of another midrash, Akiva is identified with the latter. Akiva's opinion is that the matter upon which a person's eternal reward depends is not having fulfilled the commandment of studying Torah, but upon having studied Torah. The final judgment would be something like a dissertation defense. It was that which was studied of Torah that matters. Ishmael, though, sets up Torah study as just another obligation to be fulfilled. All this, however, is prologue to the last story that Heschel cites in this chapter and the section itself. Quote, once the wicked government issued a decree forbidding the Jews to study the Torah. Pappus, son of Judah, came and found Rabbi Akiva publicly bringing gatherings together and occupying himself with the Torah. He said to him, Akiva, are you not afraid of the government? He replied, I will explain to you with a parable. A fox was walking alongside of a river, and he saw fishes going in swarms from one place to another. He said to them, from what are you fleeing? He said to them, would you like to come up on dry land so that you and I can live together in the way that my ancestors lived with your ancestors? They replied, are you the one they call the cleverest of animals? You are not clever, but foolish. If we are afraid, if we the fish are afraid of the element in which we live, how much more in the element in which we would die? So it is with us, Akiva finished. If such is our condition when we sit and study the Torah of which it is written, for that is your life and the length of your days, if we go and neglect it, how much worse will we be? The major themes of this section are brought together in this narrative. The love of God unto death, the orientation towards heaven, Torah study itself is the greatest matter. This is a totemic Akivan text. In fact, in the next scene in the narrative, which is not quoted here, Akiva is killed, martyred, and his soul leaves at the moment of unifying God. This seems to be a non-Ishmaelian text also. Rabbi Ishmael has a very minimalist understanding of martyrdom. He does not see studying Torah as the greatest matter, rather as performing a commanded activity. The one detail in this story that doesn't fit Heschel's Akiva is that Akiva was not only studying Torah. He was publicly bringing gatherings together. This seems for a minute to bleed over into the Ishmaelian side. The performance of publicly bringing gatherings together, that action is something which is of and in this world, something which would seem to be Ishmaelian. I want to argue that this moment is a bridging moment in Heavenly Torah and in Heschel's thinking. It is a moment which bridges Akiva and Ishmael. It is the transfiguration of the worldly into the sacred. To do that, I must detour for a moment to El Salvador. Oscar Arnulfo Romero y Galdamez, born October 15, 1917, was a prominent Roman Catholic priest in El Salvador during the 1960s and 70s, becoming Archbishop of San Salvador in 1977. After witnessing numerous violations of human rights, he began to speak out on behalf of the poor and the victims of repression. This led to numerous conflicts, both with the government of us in El Salvador and within the Catholic Church. On March 24, 1980, after speaking out against U.S. military support for the government of El Salvador and calling for soldiers to disobey orders to fire on innocent civilians, Archbishop Romero was shot dead while celebrating Mass at the small chapel of the cancer hospital where he lived. It is believed that those who organized his assassinations were members of Salvadoran death squads, including two graduates of the School of the Americas. Romero was radicalized and politicized when he was archbishop as a result of what he saw happening in El Salvador. In his last sermon, the night before he died, he preached, and I'm quoting, "I would like to make a special appeal to the men of the army, and specifically to the ranks of the National Guard, the police, and the military. Brothers, you come from our own people. You are killing your own brother peasants, when any human order to kill must be subordinate to the law of God, which says, 'Thou shalt not kill.' No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. No one has to obey an immoral law. It is high time you recovered your consciences and obeyed your consciences rather than a sinful order. The church, the defender of the rights of God, of the law of God, of human dignity, of the person, cannot remain silent before such an abomination. We want the government to face the fact that reforms are valueless if they are to be carried out at the cost of so much blood. In the name of God, in the name of this suffering people whose cries rise to heaven more loudly each day, I implore you, I beg you, I order you in the name of God, stop the repression." End quote. Romero issued a pastoral letter each of his years as archbishop on August 6th, the patronal feast of El Salvador. August 6th is the feast of the Transfiguration, and this was the focus of his thinking. The Transfiguration in Catholic teaching is the high point of the career of Jesus. He is brought to a mountain traditionally named as Mount Tabor. As he stands on the mountain with Peter, James, and John, Moses and Elijah appear and stand with him. His face shines as the sun, just as Moses' face shone when he came down from Sinai. A voice from the cloud says, "This is my son, whom I love, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." This is the moment when the mortal Jesus is transfigured and becomes the divine Jesus. It is the moment theologically before Calvary, that is, the crucifixion. In Romero's teaching, the meaning of the Transfiguration is as an ongoing event in the life of the church. Romero preached that the transfiguration of Jesus was a model for transfiguring the Word of God so that it would be part of the body of the people, and so that the body of the people, their material reality, would be the Word of God. In Romero's words, quote, "For this reason, every Sunday I am concerned about placing the Word of God within the framework of the events that occurred during the week. Each Sunday we discover events that ask for the light of God's word. True Christians in El Salvador, unless they want to profess a Christianity that has no roots, cannot set aside these realities. Indeed, a Christianity that avoids commitments or that is simply spiritual is a very easy Christianity because it is separated from and not incarnated in the realities of our lives." Or, and that's the end of the quote. Or as Margaret Field summarizes it, quote, "The luminous hope of Jesus' transfigured body shines forth precisely in the crucified body of Christ in history. In the Salvadoran people's own bloodied testament to the truth of God's glory in the poor person fully alive. The glory and power of God in Jesus Christ is found precisely in the midst of the Salvadoran national process," he insisted, "and the scandal of the cross and of pain will not make us flee from Christ, rejecting suffering, but rather embrace it," end quote. Romero preached that the material reality of the Salvadoran people, the people in history and the historical events, are transfigured by the people of God, the church, as divine, when understood through the filter of the life of Christ, Tabor, the Transfiguration, and Calvary, the Crucifixion. I want to suggest that Romero's transfiguration theology can help illuminate part of Heschel's framing of heavenly Torah, which has largely gone unnoticed or been ignored. That is the paragraph I cited at the beginning of this paper. Quote, "The fact that at a crossroads in Jewish history, two fathers of the world met, men who were to become trailblazers in religious philosophy is of major importance. The meeting of intellectual giants of opposing aspirations who debated on issues of ultimate significance inevitably laid bare problems in religious faith that the sages tended to conceal. For Heschel, it is centrally important that Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael are actual people who met and they lived lives in the world. The moment in which Akiva, quote, publicly brings gatherings together to study Torah is not only a bridging moment between the transcendent Ishmaelian and immanentist Akivan theologies, it is also a transfigurative moment in which the events of the world become part of the sacred story. I am suggesting that for Heschel, Akiva and Ishmael meet at that moment where real events in the world are transfigured by a partnership between people and God into matters of Torah. In an earlier section, in a chapter titled The Sufferings of God, Heschel writes, quote, how can you sustain God's power and glory in the place where you teach his need for salvation? It is possible that just as the Creator, that the earth is filled with his glory, minimized, same, his presence between the curtains of the ark in order to reveal his word to Moses, so too did God minimize his presence into the history of Israel in order to be revealed with his chosen people. It is within this framework that we can understand Heschel's political activism. In his essay, The Moral Outrage of Vietnam, Heschel writes that, quote, the encounter between man and God is an encounter within the world. We meet within a situation of shared suffering, of shared responsibility. Heschel saw in the actual lived reality of Akiva and Ishmael modes of response to actual events in the world. In acting in the world, he was choosing to act in the footsteps of either Akiva or Ishmael or both. However, it was only in acting in the world that there was significance to the engagement with, partnership with God. Quote, God is a partner with the suffering of beings, unquote. Heschel writes in the introduction. The history of Israel's exile is also a history of God's exile, since God is part and parcel of history and vice versa. Heschel's political activism fulfills a deep theological need and spiritual longing. It is only in the public sphere, the sphere of history, that the ideologies of Rabbis Akiva and Ishmael can be brought into complementarity. Akiva's publicly gathering communities as a reaction to the evil decree was the point. This was what brought history into the study hall, and bringing the study hall into the public, pointing to the suffering of racism, poverty, and militarism as part of the suffering of God. In this way, history is transfigured. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Arye, for opening this conference with a really important question, which I will just reprise. Why did Heschel leave his study at JTS to make his way to Riverside Church, symbolizing not only his movement from a world of cerebral scholarship to a life of committed activism, but also his exit from a wholly Jewish world to a wider Christian world, alive with possible ecumenical and theological affinities? In attempting to trace this journey, Arye takes us on his own path to a place he knows well, the mind of the rabbis, with some forays into modern Jewish and Christian thought. And what I would like to do in the next few minutes is to retrace some of the paths, some of the stations along the path that Arye laid out for us, and then pose a number of questions. So let me identify five steps down the path. First, Arye opens with an interesting aside which may reveal more than he thinks, namely, Heschel did not ground his ethical commitment in Jewish law, in halakha. We might say this is an obvious case in which Heschel turned to the prophets for inspiration. But no, Arye points out, Heschel's activism is not to be found necessarily in the prophets, by which he means Heschel's book of 1962 of that title, or at least not exclusively so. It is also to be found in Torah Min HaShamayim, that seminal two-volume theological meditation published in Hebrew in that same year, 1962. This leads to the second step. Torah Min HaShamayim, Heavenly Torah,
features a different theological perspective and a different account of theodicy than the book The Prophets. In The Prophets, God suffers on account of Israel, whereas in Heavenly Torah, God suffers with Israel. The latter relationship then is neither punitive nor imbalanced, but relational, indeed a partnership. Now the third step is the longest. Aryeh presents a detailed analysis of and juxtaposition between two distinct worldviews in Heavenly Torah. Not between a prophetic and a rabbinic point of view, but two varieties of rabbinic thought. That of Rabbi Akiva and that of Rabbi Ishmael from the early second century. The contrast could not be clearer between Akiva's and Ishmael's worldviews. In an immanent versus transcendent take on God, an impulse to love God versus an impulse to fulfill commandments as a manifestation of love for God, a commitment to study Torah rather than a commitment to fill the mitzvah of studying Torah. Simply put, Akiva seeks unmediated access to God, while Ishmael is mindful of the fact that when one can only seek to know God in mediated form. So we have two distinct worldviews that echo throughout Jewish history that are rooted in this encounter, as it were, between two late antique rabbis, that of the mystic and messianist on one hand, and that of the rationalist on the other. Now, all seems to be proceeding nicely with the contrast until Aryeh notes a disruption in Heschel's account. Akiva would convene public gatherings of Torah scholars, which Aryeh seems to suggest to us has a kind of Ishmaelian air to it. And this leads to the fourth step in the journey, the transfiguration of the world into the sacred. Aryeh first engages that theme by recalling the life and teaching of the martyred Archbishop of San Salvador, Oscar Romero, who spoke truth to power, calling on Salvadoran soldiers to resist orders to kill their innocent countrymen, an act that led to his assassination in 1980. The Archbishop would regularly issue pastoral letters on August 6th, the date of the Feast of the Transfiguration, which recalls the seminal moment in which Jesus undergoes a sort of metamorphosis on Mount Tabor when God says, "This is my Son, whom I love, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him," from the book of Matthew. Transfiguration is the moment at which the worldly and sacred blend. Now, the fifth and final step in Aryeh's presentation is to apply the metaphor of transfiguration to Heschel's understanding of the rabbis, especially Akiva and Ishmael, to his own theology, that is Heschel's, and to our understanding of the link between human and divine realms that culminates in the ideal of partnership. It also sheds light on the very connection between learning and activism that really is so central to Aryeh's title. Now, this series of steps, these five steps, offer much rich material for inspiration. They also raise a number of questions, or clusters of questions, and I'd like to just call our attention to three of them. First, an exegetical question. How are we to read the story of Jesus' transfiguration? Is this the kind of divine human partnership that Aryeh, following Heschel, holds out at the beginning? The first part of the story in Matthew 17:5 is really a top-down case of divine descent. God alights to shine a light on Jesus, imparts orders to the humans below, and then retreats. Those accompanying Jesus fall to the ground in terror at this spectacle. But then the vector of authority shifts. Jesus touches them and encourages them to get up and not be afraid. So is his uplifting of the disciples the kind of fusion of the human and divine realms that Aryeh and Heschel have in mind? Or is it Jesus himself who embodies the kind of human-divine partnership that they have in mind? And if so, can that Christian and Christological model help us to understand Heschel's path from the Jewish Theological Seminary to Riverside Church? A related cluster of epistemological questions. To enter into a partnership with God, do we need to know God? But how can we know God? Or do we, in the way of the mystics, the Kabbalists, the Chassidim, and others, not know, but rather feel God? The question is all the more vexed when we talk about loving God. How can we love without knowing God? Here we would seem to fall back on the Akiva-Ishmael divide. Ishmael would say that we must know in order to fulfill the commandment of loving God, while Akiva would say that we simply must love God. Is the Akivan way necessarily the way to affect the partnership with God that animates the quest for social justice? I'm asking you that question, Aryeh, not only because Akiva's apocalyptic messianic view, culminating in his support of and death in the Bar Kokhba revolt, seems to be at odds with your own embrace of nonviolent activism, but also because you use Ishmaelian logic in your own books, analyzing carefully the thinking of rabbis, often hyper-rationalist rabbis such as Maimonides, to inform and animate your own activism, which is, I must say, a great inspiration to me. Can we ever avoid the epistemological imperative of knowing before loving or partnering? If we cannot, then we always must be painfully aware of our own cognitive limitations. But if we can, how do we vacate the mind to love? Is that the real act of spiritual audacity, to believe that we can love and partner with God without fully knowing God? And then finally, a theological political question. What does all this have to do with activism? Is the partnership with God necessary for activism? What's the value added of religion to such activism? Now, in this vein, I'm not sure that Akiva's convening of a public symposium, what you call a dissertation defense, represents or need represent a religious act or that it manifests a partnership with God. What it does represent is exit from the state of self-absorption, so familiar to academics, I should say, and secular ones at that, into the world, a move from the private to the public sphere, a version of what a much later philosopher would call the leap into existence. Must we wait for God's hand in partnership before leaping into existence? Or does the urgency of the moment require a different, maybe more realistic strategy, a greater degree of theological and epistemological modesty in the form of imitatio Dei, imitation of God, rather than waiting for God to join us in partnership? God, who so often, especially in modern times, has manifested what is called in the Jewish tradition hester panim, a concealment of the face. Or perhaps the urgency of the moment, of Baltimore and Ferguson and Nepal and Jerusalem and Gaza and Damascus and Sana'a, perhaps the urgency requires of us the opposite, the impulse to demand that God join us in partnership. Is that the spiritual audacity that is required? Now, this matter of a partnership is a tricky one. What does or should or can it look like? So I can think of four variations of the theme, and I'm sure there are many more. First, there's what we might call the colonial model, whereby God descends to bestow beneficence as an act of grace to human beings, the junior partners. Second, there's what we might call the post-colonial model, whereby human beings upend the existing hierarchy and demand their own new relationship, but now as the senior partners. Third, there's the level playing field model, where God and humans meet as equals, finally overcoming generations of a seemingly intractable power differential. And fourth, there is the imitative model, where the human being abjures the prospect of a full partnership and contents herself with simply imitating. Heschel, it seems to me, was drawn to the third option, the level playing field, albeit with traces of both the colonial and post-colonial. His homo religiosus, spiritual person, was consumed with reverence, but reverence of a special sort that afforded the spiritual person, and here I'm quoting, a unique kind of transparency about things and events. The world is seen through, and no veil can conceal God completely. So the pious man is ever alert to see behind the appearance of things a trace of the divine, and thus his attitude toward life is one of expectant reverence, unquote. that cognitive, emotive, and moral power to pierce the veil of God's concealment is the ground of man's spiritual force and the quest for social justice at once. But can we achieve it? Must we achieve it to act? I conclude with these recurrent questions as a coda to Arya's brilliant reading of Heschel on Akiva and Ishmael. And I'm now going to offer you an opportunity to say a brief word, and then we'll open up for the 3 minutes of questions that time will allow us. So, Arya.
Thank you so much. I think the questions that David asked are actually kind of the questions that animate thinking about Heschel. Because Heschel is, as I tried to describe, Heschel is not easily cubbyholed as a religious activist. Heschel is not easily cubbyholed as those who say that they're going to pray with their feet, when what they mean is that they're going to march in a demonstration. So what I was trying to bring together, and I think this is where to just, I'm not going to talk about all the questions, I think, because I think they should stand in the chamber of the room, but I think that what Romero's understanding of transfiguration, so Romero's transfiguration is I was talking Dafka about Romero's transfiguration, just like I was talking about Heschel's Akiva and Ishmael, and not the transfiguration. And so for Romero, the transfiguration was definitely not a top-down, because for Romero, the transfiguration, what actually was being transfigured from Tabor to Calvary, from transfiguration to crucifixion, was what was going on in the world, in the lives of the people of the church, who then became the body of Christ. And it's that moment, right? It's that making, transfiguring the material reality of the world into the divine, which I saw, or which I wanted to use to filter that moment when Akiva goes out into public and actually brings together people in reaction to the decree, according to the story, in reaction to the decree, and brings that reality of reacting to the decree into the divine. And that transfigures that moment. So that was what was important to me about Romero. I think these other the other questions are great questions, and I think they also talk to something which is also really important. It's important constantly to problematize Heschel as simply liberal or progressive or activist or thinker. Heschel was, I think, a specific type of religious thinker for whom navigating the relationship between God and people in the world was part and parcel of, or only could be done through, also creating justice in the world. So therefore, it wasn't a demand for justice, it was a demand for navigating this relationship, which then can only be filtered through this way of sharing in God's suffering. And God suffers when there is suffering in the world, when people suffer, just as people suffer when God is in exile and God suffers. And that's not, you know, if one, so I also want to say that it's not then a clear march from point A to point B. It's not clear that you start at Heschel and you get to, you know, as we were on Thursday night, marching in support of Baltimore and, you know, in Freddie Gray. It is understanding that the suffering in the world is part of the suffering in God, and that we have to take part in that, that brings us out, that brings Heschel out to the street. And if we want to follow in Heschel's footsteps, as Heschel is following in Akiva and Ishmael's footsteps, it doesn't mean simply moving from point A to point B, but it means trying to navigate that relationship, trying to navigate that chasm, right? And also, as you pointed out, that tension between the messianic, the mystical, and the rationalist, right? And that tension, and when to move to one place or another. And so, it's to a certain extent. So that tension abides And there's a certain complementarity when one goes out into the street, both metaphorically and really, right, in the events of the world. So I think I'll stop there, and I'll let, I'd love to hear from everybody.
We have time for some questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think you mind move there? Yeah. So just to confuse things a little bit, see if we can work this out. So, questions, comments, thoughts. Floor is open. Distinguished gentlemen, just delegate to Rabbi Nachman Elyahu.
Sorry. All right, I think the example that you gave of Rabbi Akiva going out and establishing places of learning is not the same at all as social action. I mean, this is going to give you the willies, but the Haredim in Israel think that when they set up places of learning, they are doing God's work for them. You know, for the world. And in place of, in fact, what you and I would call doing God's work for the world. Right? So, I mean, I don't think that Rabbi Akiva going out and establishing a house of study is at all a paradigm.
So it's not him. Is there a moving mic for children? So the question was, did everybody hear the question?
We phrased it.
So the question was that when Akiva's establishing study places, going out and establishing study places, is not necessarily what we would call social justice work, because when the Haredim, for example, in Israel, establish places of study, they do it instead of doing what we would call social justice. So if I guess I wasn't clear enough. But it's what Akiva was doing was in response to the Roman decree against learning, that Akiva established. Akiva was makil kilot barabim. He didn't establish study places. He brought people together to learn in the market. Right? He was going out into the public place as a public demonstration of the fact that we would learn. Because Akiva didn't need the marketplace to learn. Right? And that's what Papa says. Papa is basically coming back to him and saying, if you want to learn, go sit in your house and learn. And why are you provoking the Roman Empire? This is to another point that David made. This is, I think, kind of an essential moment of nonviolent activism. Right? What Martin Luther King taught us is that one of the things that nonviolent activism is supposed to do is it forces the oppressor to do in public what they want to do in private. And so when the Roman government says, don't learn, and what Akiva does is he brings people together in public to learn, that is saying, okay, you're moving.
Right.
Right? And that move and that bringing the people into the public to learn in that situation, not as a general thing, in that situation is very definitely, I think, an act of social justice, an act of nonviolent resistance.
But if I could just jump in and sort of continue this interesting line of questioning, it's not an instance then of Torah Lishma, Torah study for its own sake. It's a very instrumentalized view of Torah study as a manifestation of the act of civil disobedience, which is, in a certain sense, the main point here. Torah study sort of simply as a way of representing that protest against an authoritarian.
Correct, and in that way, another bridging of Akiva and Ishmael. Right? Because for Akiva, Torah study should be just Torah study. So why the fact that Torah study is doing something else, as you say, that's an Ishmaelian move, not an Akivan move.
And we'll let Elliot follow up.
Then I'm going to flip the question.
A little louder.
Okay, then I'm going to flip the question. Then that's a very narrow understanding of social justice. You only have social justice when you are objecting to what the ruling regime is doing. So if you do Jewish Family Service, for example, where you have no problem whatsoever with what the regime is doing, as a matter of fact, you're applying for government funds, that's not social action on this view.
Okay, so... Elliot Dorf, I'm sure, like everybody in the room knows, the record of social justice received mine by decades. But his challenge is that, but there's that only presumes that social justice comes in a situation of confrontation, and not when there's family service or when you're supporting poverty relief, all kinds of
seeking support.
And there, you're not actually opposing the government. You're actually with the government. So I am distinguishing here between social justice and social action, as you did purposely or not in the end of the time. And yes, social action is different than social justice. And social justice has a component of demanding justice. And when you demand justice, you are confronting those who are not giving justice. And so otherwise you wouldn't have to demand it. So I would make that.
Good questions?
Yes, please.
The Hasidic tradition in which Heschel was raised sublimated all of those impulses towards social action and historical political action into mysticism, internal strife within the soul. How did Heschel break out of that and suddenly rediscover social action in the world?
So that's a great question, which is way beyond this, but I'll give a stab at an answer. So I think Heschel's second part of his magnum opus is his book on Kant. After Tarana Shimon Hermann Torres, his book on Grandel von der Emmes, the struggle with truth, translated as something else. But there, the two poles are Kant and measurement. And his active part there is the Kant, right, who actually goes out and has fierceness and is in the world and speaks about mendacity. So what I think happened actually is that Heschel in his youth left. Not completely left, but Heschel in his youth went and hung out with the people who were writing poetry and were politically active, and then went to Berlin, and then came back, and first he got to, when he came to the States, and this is the historical part of this question, David could answer far better than I, but after the Holocaust, he came to the States, he was saved. He recognized, he couldn't understand, he talked about racism as being a problem of optics. Like, he couldn't understand why some people saw people differently than other people. And so that struck him. Right? And so therefore he saw something wrong. And then he went back and found that. The way to respond to that, right, as opposed to just, the move is always, you see something wrong. And then there's a grand canyon between you see something wrong and you do something wrong, right? And he found in the tradition, both in Kiva and Ishmael and also in the Hasidic tradition, which agreed, is a unique reading of that Hasidic tradition, because one would normally think that it's a quietist tradition. He took that out into the world. That's as good as I can get.
I suppose I could add just a general historical observation, which is that.
Can I just comment on that and just say that I don't think that Hasidic rebbes were entirely divorced from political issues. If you think about the Buddhist Yisrael, for example, and other kinds of social problems, they were very much engaged. And then also, I would just say that, just as a reminder, that when my father was in Germany, he was already doing what he could politically. It was Nazi Germany, that he was speaking to different groups, Catholic, Quaker, and so forth. He came to this country in March. In 1943, with the rabbis at the big demonstration in Washington, we spoke out against the Korean War and so on. So sometimes I think people think it only started in the 60s, but it really was much
earlier. I suppose I would join that observation as well by making a kind of generational point, which is Heschel belonged to a generation of Eastern European Jews who no longer lived what Derrida later sort of described as the principle of there being nothing beyond the text. They broke out of the text. In the first instance, this was an intellectual move when thousands of Eastern Europeans, after the First World War, moved to places like Germany to receive a different kind of education than they had previously. That was a breaking out of a certain kind of textual universe that was absolutely mind-altering for many, including Heschel, who met up with some of the most important figures in 20th century Judaism. The second move, of course, is the move to the United States, which, in a certain sense, introduced him to a tradition of pragmatism, whereby thought was yoked to action in a very, very direct way, and he was thrust into, well, had been thrust really from the 30s into the great events of the 20th century, but now yoked that to this American pragmatism that demanded action.
and a quest for justice. I think, by the way, Susanna, your first point about not misrepresenting traditionalist Orthodox rabbis and their putative indifference to the world is a very helpful observation. You wouldn't want to make that case. The Yehuda and many, many other examples can be pointed to of an intense engagement with the world with social welfare issues. So there are distinctions we can also make, but it's, I think it's important to make that, offer that correctly. Yeah, Mark.
Well, your comments about where we and God meet or fit, I'm struck by Rabbi Heschel's question in the book Insecurity of Freedom in that first treatise, that the first talk he gave, I think, was in 1958, Religion in a Free Society, where he said, God asks us the question, what is life getting out of us? And I think, for me, that's always struck me as where Rabbi Heschel always brought God here, for me, in all of his writings. And yet knew that God was ineffable and infinite. And he was able to, he taught me how to live in both of those worlds. And I'm just wondering what you and I really think about that.
As always, you left me somewhat speechless. I think what Heschel's in the 50s, and I think that David talked about, in the 50s, what was powerful about Heschel is that it was a time when anti-communism, secular, the communists were secular and godless, and America was the own God, we had the monopoly of God. God's pledge of allegiance. And Heschel basically said, all right, you want to play that? Are you really serious about God? If you're really serious about the fact that God is here, what does that mean? What is that obligation? God is not just another commodity that we have. God is not another asset. God is demanding. Right? And that's, and that already goes back to actually, the nature of this moment, which is the speech of the Quakers in Germany, and he reiterated that and goes on further. And his vision, which also becomes clear then in 63, and his speech at the Conference on Race and Religion, is that, he said, this is an ongoing fight between God and Pharaoh, and you've got to choose sides. And that's that at the first Conference on Race and Religion, there were two people, it was Moses and Pharaoh. That's what Heschel said. And so, what Heschel was able to speak in a language, I'm not sure if it would be, of course these things are counter-history, you actually wrote something in the how would Heschel sound like today? Who knows? But in that moment, in that place, Heschel spoke in the language of, this is what God wants from you if you want to say that this is the country under God.
Mark, I just want to thank you for putting your finger on, in a certain sense, one of the deepest variants of the human condition, which is to call attention to the tension between the belief in the ineffability of God and the deeply unsatisfying nature of that theological proposition, the aridity that attends it. And I think you've given eloquent testimony, as many people in this room no doubt share, the sentiment that Heschel was able somehow to maintain fealty to the Ishmaelian position, the Maimonidean position, as a reflection of his own rationalist sense and sensibility, but at the same time to critique it internally and to push against it and to offer, as he did in that quote, in which I included my remarks, this idea of glimpsing through the veil of concealment to actually begin to see. You've absolutely captured that profound tension which adheres in at least one important version of the human condition. we've opened up a number of questions, answered probably very few of them, but it seems to me that's why we have another 2 days of our conference. With that, I would like to thank my friend and colleague.